So why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride, because we are going to have some fun going green.
And Abby said you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a lowlife.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against this. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. The general population again.
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only Stalinists would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party. Because I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get the communist dollar, gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
Okay, welcome to the Three Left Show after that extended intro because we have the pledge drive stuff. I'm your host, Dan Platt, and this is the Three Left Show. If we're going a different direction.
I'm your co-host, Michael Walsh, and this program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. A left that is of itself and for itself, the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. This show proudly waves the flags of the three lefts.
Okay, so we got a jam-packed number of topics today, and we have a guest for the second hour, assuming that happens. So, all things being preparing for the worst, good will happen on its own. So, but I want to do some media literacy stuff, since we're doing a pledge drive. We're trying to let people know why we're valuable. Why should we be supported? We need to ask all our friends and family for donations, which I've not yet done. Let's get on that. Come on, Dan. Do it. Ask people. People do not give you money or support unless you ask. You have to ask. So that's like rule one of fundraising. Like, you just have to ask. Like, people will respond well. So I got a number of things that have to do with mass media. Mass movements require mass media. Let's talk about that. So I have from The Baffler, which I actually bought a physical copy of. So it's called The Gray Zone Lady by Ross Barkin, Disarray and Indecision on the New York Times Politics Desk. Now I'm going to read all of this, but there are certain sections that I think are relevant. First section I'm going to read is about, basically, you know, in the last decade, mass media, corporate, profit-driven news, you know, because basically when it comes to writing news is expensive, but also, I mean, it just costs money. It's actual labor to actually report, gather information, do fact-checking, actually make sure things are accurate. Out of the smoldering ashes of the newspaper business soars the Times, for the New York Times. Although no single newspaper can agenda set like it did back in the 60s, when reality filtered through far fewer prisms, at the dawn of the 2020s, the Times is paradoxically both more or less and less influential than it was in the analog age, a great colossus by virtue of its native resources and eviscerated competition. So, monopoly. If, over the next few thousand words, I write of all the ways the Times newspaper I still admire has failed, I do so with the caveat that if it were to go away for good, we would all be far worse off. There is a fewer and fewer organizations that can afford to do what the Times does. Newspapers, with few exceptions, do not dispatch reporters to foreign countries and leave them there. They do not operate functioning weekly book review sections. They do not maintain bureaus in states thousands of miles from Manhattan. They do not finance months-long investigations into corporate and government malfeasance. Now, I have to ask a question. What is the point of these investigations if no political solutions can actually come of it. You know, it's kind of assuming that if people are mad enough and informed that they can do something about it, but living in a plutocracy, we functionally can't. It's aesthetically irksome as the digital media boom of the 2010s could be. It's a tragedy that it didn't last. Investment money for this dried up because there was not a sufficiently profitable way to undertake news reporting. Tech companies operate under the fantasy of galactic profits. Uber has never made a cent, but its market saturation and fraudulent, though saleable, mythos allowed it to swallow endless rounds of investment capital. Somehow they still think they're getting money back. Let's see, skipping ahead. So the Times published like a headline where Trump, a shooting or something, that Trump urges unity versus racism, and their readership, because they actually have a due-paying membership, can actually lean on them to actually change their headlines and react to their readership, where before they maybe didn't have to care. Let's see, in the Gray Citadel, the Timesmen of you know the 60s could have brushed off the ruckus and moved on, but the Trump unity controversy crystallized how little the leadership in the news division has prepared for the world it has inherited. One without revered gatekeepers and with higher demands from the empowered audience. The people who read the Times, rightly enough, understand that both sideism concerning Trump is absurd, the equivalent of trying to write about George Wallace's effort to court black voters in a so-called balanced manner. But balance of a false and illusory kind is something the Times is relentlessly committed to as long as executive editor Dean Barquette leads the paper. So this is kind of a point about how, like, maybe they're not billionaire-owned like the New York Washington Post is,
right,
by Bezos, but right. They're still tied to these old ideologies of balance and objectivity, that their value lies and that their membership value, their membership who actually pay the subscription, value these things, when really they right. kind of want them to be part of the resistance. But then he adds that their role is not to be the leader of the resistance, Beckett said in CNN last year, adding that one of the problems that would come about if the paper took on such a role as like an opposition to power,
right,
is that inevitably the resistance in America wins, he added.
Yeah.
Inevitably, the people outside power gain power again. So this is just referring to party politics, that like the other side of the ruling class gain power.
Right.
So it's really just talking about power in the elitist fashion, that the only people that matter our readers, maybe, who are professional class liberals, not like people power, or, you know, we're always out of power. So, like, we're not that resistance, the resistance of Democrats. Let's see. But then you're just the chump of the people who won. Our role is to hold everyone who has power to account. So the problem with this is that if you only cover those with currently power, then you create the world where that's all that is and all that can be. No one else can have power, or let's say the marginalized or the poor. They, you know, you read the New York Times and it's just the people who have power, which is then, it naturally becomes horse race coverage,
right. Yeah.
Which is where this guy kind of says, so the rest of the article is devoted to that, but mostly how it was kind of a slow process where the New York Times just hired a lot of reporters from Politico. Because Politico kind of pioneered just doing horse race politics.
Right.
And what is horse race politics? That about like Harris's, they just cover Harris's campaign. It's really a quite, oh yeah. And then there's this page here is about the, when covering the Trump impeachment, they right. talked about Nancy Pelosi's dress.
Ugh.
Or the suit pants she wore and the pin and how important the pin was and how, let's see, how many words was it? A lot of words. Yeah, okay, it starts with trivial pantsuits. The Times, particularly in its approach to national political stories, has clung to a horse race model of coverage that should have been discredited decades ago. The model, long derided but shockingly durable, operates from a rather simple premise. How do we figure out who's going to win? It is rarely curious about anything else, and it can be applied to political campaigns and governing policy alike. Horse race coverage treats politics as a glorified sporting event, each side reduced to a combatant of equal moral stature, whether they're fascist or not fascist alike, right. Or the new old fascist versus the new fascist. Which fascist is going to win?
Yeah.
Let's see. With all the arrogance of science and none of its corresponding rigor, it regards political reportage as theater criticism, diminishing pivotal and thorny questions about policy. The other question horse race coverage may ask, how does this play? Instead of asking whether a certain candidate will support more drone strikes in the Middle East or will pursue a health care policy that makes coverage cheaper or more humane, the horse race paradigm is more concerned about tactics. Will an embrace of X lead to victory or defeat? What is the underlying strategy? Political coverage becomes inseparable from gossip. Such an approach relishes artificial events constructed specifically to make news, like the press conference, the dinner visit, or the rally with surrogates. Campaign operatives tasked with massaging the truth repeatedly for the benefit. And of course, you know, since the aughts, this has all been like an observable, like, this is a problem. And yet, it similar to the Democratic Party, it's like, well, what other game is there? If I'm going to be paid for being a media person, I have to interact with this. And that's a trap. That's the trap of, I guess, wage labor. Yeah. But just generally being in capitalism. So let's see. I want to cover the last few paragraphs, which is this type of reporting perceived national political work the Times prizes most? Meaning like covering the campaigns themselves and not actually like, and whether or not they're getting voter attention, not whether like they actually have policies. And they merit out punishments basically by taking people out of the Beltway beats and putting them in, say, the Metro beat, and that's their punishment. The Times' long-term prognosis is better than most, like the Washington Post, the New Yorker, and other news orgs, and mags with universal name recognition. They have the subscriber base and the goodwill to survive industry cataclysm. This resiliency creates greater responsibility, though, in our diminished age to defy its worst impulses and discard tired models. Of course, it doesn't look like there's any movement towards that. The Times, as Tallis wrote, remains something of a modern medieval kingdom. It will be up to its leadership to decide how much it wants to change its private laws and values for a world that demands much more of its considerable resources and clout. So if you leave it up to the kings of the castle, I think you should abandon all hope.
Yeah.
Same as leadership of the Senate and so on and so on. So this will lead us to the longer piece from Nathan Robinson of... it's Current Affairs, his little baby, which is also partly funded by supporters. Okay. The truth is paywalled, but the lies are free. Do you want to start this one?
Yeah.
Since you called it up.
Do.
Let's see. I think this could be worth reading all. Yeah, yeah. It's not terribly long. It's not three.
Paywalls are justified, even though they are annoying. It costs money to produce good writing, to run a website, to license photographs. A lot of money. If you want quality, asking people for a fee to access content is therefore very reasonable. Wow, just a lot of good capitalist propaganda, but I'm going to keep going.
And this is an anarchist speaking.
Yeah. You don't expect to get a print subscription to the newspaper gratis. Why would a website be different? I try not to grumble about having to pay for online content because I run a magazine and I know how difficult it is to pay writers what they deserve. But let us also notice something. The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The New Republic, New York Harper's, The New York's Review of Books, The Financial Times, The New London Times, all have paywalls. Breitbart, Fox News, The Daily Wire, The Federalist, The Washington Examiner, InfoWars, free. You want Portland protesters burn Bibles, American flags in the streets, or the moral case against mask mandates and other COVID restrictions, or an article suggesting the National Institutes of Health have admitted 5G phones cause coronavirus? They're yours. You want the Times reports on the neo-Nazis infiltrating German institutions, the reason contact tracing is failing in U.S. states, or the Trump administration's undercutting of the USPS's effectiveness? Well, you've clicked around the website a bit, you'll run straight into a paywall. This doesn't mean the paywall shouldn't be there, but it does mean that it costs time and money to access a lot of true and important information, while a lot of bullshit is completely free. Now, crucially, I do not mean to imply here that reading the New York Times gives you a sound grasp of reality.
We just covered that.
I have documented many times how the Times misleads people. For instance, by repeating the dubious idea that we have a border crisis of migrants pouring into this country, or that Russia is trying to steal life-saving vaccine research. And that should be free anyway. But it's important to understand the problem with the Times. It is not the facts it reports tend to be inaccurate, though sometimes they are, but that the facts are presented in a way that misleads. There is no single fact in the migrant story or the Russia story that I take issue with. What I take issue with is the conclusions that are being drawn from the facts. Likewise, the headline, U.S. says Hussein intensifies quest for A-bomb parts, is technically accurate. The U.S. government did, in fact, say that. It was just not true. The New York Times is, in fact, extremely valuable if you read it critically and look past the headlines. Usually the truth is in there, somewhere.
Page 12.
As there is a great deal of excellent reporting, and one could almost construct a serious newspaper purely from material culled from the New York Times. I've written before about the Times reporting on Hitler and the Holocaust. It wasn't that the grim facts of the situation were left out of the paper, but they were buried at the back and treated as unimportant. It was changes in emphasis that were needed because the facts were there in black and white.
He's actually talking about back in the early 40s.
Wow. This means that a lot of the most vital information will end up locked behind the paywall. And while I'm not much of a New Yorker fan either, it's concerning that the Hoover Institute will freely give you Richard Epstein's infamous article downplaying the threat of coronavirus, but Isaac Chotiner's interview demolishing Epstein requires a monthly subscription, meaning that the lie is more acceptable than its refutation. Eric Levitz of New York is one of the best and most prolific left political commentators we have. Yeah.
I would know, but I probably read stuff at least sometime. I don't know.
But unless you're a subscriber of New York, you won't get to hear much of what he has to say each month.
Because unless, like, he's doing a speaking engagement.
Right.
But then it's like an hour interview or something.
Yeah.
It's not a pithy PragerU vid, you know?
Right.
If we had Red Star U, which, you know, is a joke video that I could play, we would have him on or something.
Possibly even worse is the fact that so much academic writing is kept behind vastly more costly paywalls. A white supremacist on YouTube will tell you about race and IQ. But if you want to read a careful scholarly refutation, obtaining a legal PDF from the journal publisher will cost you $14.95, a price nobody in their right mind would pay for one article if they can't get institutional access. I recently gave up on trying to access a scholarly article because I could not find a way to get it for less than $39.99. God dang.
Oh, that's just the beginning.
Though, in that case, the article was garbage rather than gold. Academic publishing is a nightmarish patchwork, with lots of articles advertised at exorbitant fees on one site, and then for free on another, or accessible only through certain databases, which your university or public library might not have access to. Libraries have to budget carefully, because subscription prices are often nuts. A library subscription to the Journal of Coordination Chemistry, for instance, costs, what?
$11,367
annually. Of course, people can find their ways around paywalls. Sci-Hub is completely illegal, but extremely convenient means of obtaining academic research for free. I am purely describing it, not advocating it. You can find a free version of the article debunking race and IQ myths on ResearchGate, a site that has engaged in mass copyright infringement in order to make research accessible, often because journal researchers tightly control access to their copyrighted work in order to charge those exorbitant fees for PDFs. The versions of articles that you get for free are drafts that have not yet gone through peer review, and thus been subject to less scrutiny. This means that the more reliable an article is, the less accessible it is. On the other hand, pseudo-scholarship is easy to find. Right-wing think tanks like the Cato Institute, the Foundation for Economic Education, the Hoover Institution, Mackinac Center, the American Enterprise Institute, and the Heritage Foundation pump out slickly produced policy documents on every subject under the sun. They are utterly untrustworthy. The conclusion is always going to be, let the free market handle the problem, no matter what the problem is or what the facts of the case. But it is often dressed up to look sober-minded and non-ideological.
So let me jump in. Why are we so... Why are the country so misinformed?
I had a meme that says this exact same thing, and it's like...
It's where the people probably paying for these subscriptions for, say, New York Magazine are liberal Biden supporter
right.
types, and yet... So they should have the best understanding that monopoly power is what is destroying everything.
Yeah.
The monopoly is the true enemy. Monopoly is what makes capitalism evil.
Unsustainable.
You know, unsustainable, evil, whatever,
because
unequal.
Money and power wants
even,
to become
yes.
more money and more powerful.
Even if you just want to be, you want a fair capitalism somehow. And you ignore right. all the other problems that we discuss. But let's say it's that for teach out. And... that's our position, that like as progressive, it's just about fighting monopoly.
Right.
And they don't seem to care. Or
nope.
Fighting monopoly is like, okay, we flip the Senate, we put Dems, and then the Dems enforce monopoly laws. Except,
right.
of course, in the Obama administration or whenever we have a majority. The majority is so unstable or it's for 2 years. It doesn't matter. You weren't able to fight monopoly.
Well, ever since Reagan, we haven't given a crap about monopolies.
Yes, that is the era we have been in. We've been in the consolidation era.
We are in the neoliberal era, where
yes.
as long the main focus, or so the government says, is that they only care about keeping prices down. And as long as prices remain low, they don't care about monopoly.
And monopoly, the main argument whenever they consolidate anyway is to say, well, we're going to be able to lower prices because
right.
this lowers some overhead for us.
No, because they artificially lower the prices to beat out their competition.
Yes, yes. But that's the short term.
Yeah.
But then it hits us, and then basically half the country gets evicted. That's
yep.
as far as real estate is concerned, whether it's communications... And which is why, you know, having our own media like this and having our own support base is so necessary.
Yeah.
To plug the our pledge drive. But it's more pledges. I don't like the word pledge, but to actually have members and do paying membership.
Yeah.
But just to have like a budget every year. So otherwise we have to do this some of our board want to do this very frequently.
Yeah.
And, some of us are like, no, it should just more be a once a year thing, if anything.
Yeah.
But it's more about the membership because like we just want to be able to, we want to have the budget to actually like the dream
right.
would be, this is my full-time job. I'm actually
exactly.
going out doing reporting and not just commentary.
Right.
I can do commentary in my free time, but I do not have the motivation, but also... You know, because I want to be paid for work that's valuable. And the work that's valuable to me would be that I'm actually the city beat reporter covering all
right.
the politics in a deep, deep, substantial level.
If I'm being honest, I would love for my full-time job to be me sitting on a park corner with a sign saying, I'm running for Congress, ask me anything.
Yeah. And you'll definitely be able
well,
to do that.
Well, I'm planning on spending a lot of time in Townsend Park doing exactly that.
Townsend Park.
Not easy or cheap to be an independent researcher. When I was writing my first book, Super Predator, I wanted to look through newspapers.
Let's skip ahead.
All right.
This does seem longer now. I guess I scrolled really fast.
Oh. Yeah.
Let's see.
Doobly doobly doo.
Now, I'm not sure. There will be those who argue that any universal knowledge access system... Oh, yeah, so it describes that, you know, we need a universal knowledge access system.
Mm-hmm.
I realize that I was recommending everyone get my book from the library rather than buying it at the bookstore, that my publisher probably didn't appreciate my handling out this advice. And frankly, it made me a little nervous. I depend on for my living on my writing. So if everyone got my book from the library, it wouldn't sell any copies, and then my publisher wouldn't pay me to write any more books. We can't have too many people using the socialized information repository, meaning libraries, when authors are reliant on a capitalist publishing industry. In fact, a strange thing about the library is that we intentionally... So this is the thing about like certain anarchists like David like Robinson here, where they do not seem to actually do any practice. Like anarchists in the past would at least
Nathan
form their
Robinson
own...
is an anarchist?
He identifies as such.
Nice.
But identifying as such...
Right.
Being holding some... This is where when MLs call anarchists liberals.
Oh,
this is where it comes from because
okay.
You have all these anarchists in the past would form publishing co-ops,
right?
You know, now it's like they're working normal capitalists,
right?
And then they have to act like it despite writing the opposite like this, which give people funny ideas. But then, and this is my general rant against most. Not the left as a nebulous concept, but just like there's so many grifters that I consider grifters or people who are pseudo grifters where like say they're putting out good content, good commentary or entertainment. But at the end of the day, it's like if they're not in an organization, if they're not in a co-op of some kind, I see what they're doing is not believable. Like I don't when are others going to join things? You're going to say like, oh, we need this working class party if we're going to – we need this alternative and we need to build it over the next decade if we're not going to do the usual Dem entryism. And I'm like, okay, are you going to start? Are you going to join that?
Right.
When are you going to do it? And if you're not going to do it, why should anyone listening to you do it?
Yeah.
When are they going to do it? You're not advocating for it and you're not setting the tone and the conversation. And this frustrates me to no end. I was just ranting about it. And whether it's like, and it comes in the form of, say, me complaining about Vosh because maybe, well, see, he is autistic, but he's not doing things in public, you know? Or you have others who, like Hassan Piker has been on TV and done debates, but he doesn't, I don't think he's done public, like on the street debating or whatever.
Okay.
So when they give like optics advice of people in the street arguing with Caitlin Bennett or whatever, or some other ANCAP, it comes off as
not an ANCAP, but
whatever, you know what I mean. Disingenuous. It's like, look, who are you to give this kind of advice? You're not an expert. You're not you don't do the practice, and and this goes for like any kind of commentator. I only feel like I have some authority in my commentary because I have been doing activism for 10 years. I am in a political party, and I make and I'm public about it, and I don't make it like a sideline issue. Back to Robinson, though. And Robinson, you know, he's a pretty boy with his pork pie hat and New Yorker. And he, you know, he has his magazine and he started it specifically so that there is this platform and it's a good platform. But he still has to act like a capitalist at the end of the day. But here's his pitch here. We can't have too many people using the socialized information. Yeah, the library. In fact, a strange thing about the library is that we intentionally preserve an unnecessary inefficiency in order to keep the current content financing model afloat. Your library could just give you DRM-free PDFs of my book and every issue of Current Affairs for free, but instead they make you go to the magazine room or check out one of the limited number of copies of the book. So, false scarcity. Because while we want books and magazines to be free, we cannot have them to be as free as it is possible to make them. Or it could hurt the publishing industry too much. They could offer every book ever written. So this is just another example of capitalism doesn't actually deliver freedom and full and prosperity and bounty. It actually has to restrict the bounty in order to keep going. I also realized, however, that I wouldn't care how many people got my book for free if my compensation operated on a different structure, like, say, UBI, where I was paid by the number of people who read it rather than the number of people who bought it. Impossible, you say. Where would the money come from? We can imagine such a setup quite easily, though. We have our universal public knowledge database, and anyone who wants to, and this is something he introduced halfway into the article, that like, let's say you have a socialized information network where it's like the Library of Congress, but it actually has everything in it, not just everything that's it's free domain. So we have our knowledge database, and anyone who wants to, like what the internet actually promises to be.
Right.
And anyone who wants to can type in the title of any of my books and read them for free. But the number of people who read the book is tracked, and I am compensated $2 for every person who reads it. A pittance, but that's about what the authors get for their sales. Current Affairs, likewise, is granted a budget proportional to its readership. He's basically describing how like a state socialist apparatus would work
right.
when it comes to subsidized media that isn't controlling the media or owning right. it, like literally like Pravda. But it's more about having basically providing the database
yeah.
and organizing it and then basically being the facilitator of payment. So let's see. Likewise, Current Affairs, the magazine, would be granted a budget proportional to its readership. Compensated from where? Budget from where? Why? From the Universal Public Knowledge Database, of course. But from where do they get their money? Why? From taxes. Free at point of use service is not an alien concept. The NHS compensates doctors while charging patients nothing.
Right.
Of course, compensation for producers wouldn't even be that much of an issue in a society with a UBI or where the basics of life were guaranteed, referring to a socialist economy.
Right.
I wouldn't care about making any money on my books if I could live decently regardless. Now, I am sure that there will be those who argue that any universal knowledge access system of this kind would inhibit the creation of new work by reducing the rewards people get. But let us note a few facts. First, that people cannot be incentivized to be creative. Thus, at least everything ever created by a person who is now dead should be made freely available. Gatekeepers to intellectual products, Disney, and other media monopolies, make by the dead are parasites. The equivalent of a private individual who sets up a gate and a toll booth in the middle of a road somebody else has already built. Yada, yada.
Yeah.
Counterfactuals to basically arguing for copyrights. Copyrights shouldn't really, they're just a form of monopoly. And they only need to exist to compensate creatives in a capitalist system. If we had a socialist economy or anything that it was sort of socialist, community-based, then, of course, they wouldn't have to be starving artists, and then they wouldn't have to copyright anything. So he's just basically setting up that thought experiment of how media would work in a socialist economy without it being Pravda or or the BBC or whatever people think state-owned media is.
Right.
Because it wouldn't be state-owned media. It would just be state-managed media.
Yeah.
But it's like, and they're not deciding. They don't decide what's in there. It could be neo-Nazi propaganda, but it could also be then our anarchist propaganda.
Yeah.
And then it's totally actual. And then arguing about, let's see, does stuff calling for violence get put into the universal database? Well, technically already is, because in fact, that's what the argument here is. The stuff calling for race war and fascism is totally free. That's what's available.
Yeah.
It benefits the ruling class to put this out, or at least a section of it.
Yeah.
The domestic side, the people who make money from overspending on guns and stuff.
Yeah.
And everything else.
You're right. Oh, wait. I just want to read out this one tweet I came across because it was really funny.
Go ahead.
Let's go light. It's an anti-abortion person. And they tweeted out saying, maybe they should pass something for free condoms or free Plan B so you can stop taking the lives of innocent unborn children.
Well, we've tried that, but then they defund that too.
And then someone's like, oh, you mean like they do at Planned Parenthood? The organization y'all are literally trying to shut down?
Yeah. And I guess they want, well, they don't know what they want. That's the thing.
Yeah,
they just want no abortion. Well, they want sexual control of others. So, I mean, and
they
want
to save the babies.
Oh, I have it saved. So we'll cover this in a different, so this will link up with a different topic in another show, but to give the short version, it's religion is in fact still declining, since 2006. But one of the researchers looking at it, has a different hypothesis to why, and it's theorizing is just about how since control of reproductive capacity, birth rates, isn't important anymore. That is why, that's in his way, that's what religion is for. Regulating population. Since we don't really need to care about regulating population anymore,
yeah,
religion is less necessary and thus not playing a factor in our lives.
Yeah.
Whether you need faith in your life or not. two policing stories. I think I'm leaning toward the policing stories.
Okay.
So these are both kind of filed in the topic of Dem exit. You can't rely on the system to deliver justice when it's designed not to, and radicalization is part of recognizing that the system is working exactly as it's supposed to. That when reform is produced, it is to placate, not to actually solve the problem.
Yeah.
Especially when you think the problem is how things are done. So this is from the LA Times. Many California police reform efforts have stalled despite push from George Floyd protests. This is from the end of August, a month ago.
Okay.
Because I just looked up a article on this topic.
Yeah.
3 months after the police killing of George Floyd ignited national outrage and filled California streets with protesters, the legislature is in the final hours of a session that is poised to deliver a much more modest law enforcement reform agenda than many expected. More than a dozen bills regarding police accountability and oversight were introduced in the weeks after Floyd, a black man, was killed by Minneapolis, you know the details. By now. But weeks later, legislators are lukewarm now on passing some of those reforms, just like single payer, just like anything of value. Backers blame several factors from external sources, a shortened session due to coronavirus, to fierce opposition from law enforcement unions, which have long been a major power player in Sacramento. Some of the measures that failed to advance include a proposed law to require fellow officers to intervene if they witness excessive force, a plan to streamline oversight boards of sheriff's departments, and an attempt to further constrict how police use deadly force. So it's really just controlling how lethal they can be, not really accountable, but it's like we're just looking at reducing killings.
Yeah.
We could just do that at least. No, even that is too far for the reactionaries. The showing underscores the challenge of sweeping police reform, even in a liberal state like California, where polls show wide support for these measures, or some of them. Many times you have folks in our world, elected officials, who are there for the photo op, the press conference. But when it comes to standing up and doing the real thing, they fade into the shadows, said State Senator Stephen Bradford, author of the most controversial remaining measure that would strip bad officers of their badges. They run from police when it comes to standing up for them. So this is a champion of the movement. This is a term that lobbyists use. Like a champion is someone who's like bombastic and like they're out front.
Right.
They're, you know, the legislative leader. This is what has these folks in fear, the threat of the union coming after them. Along with Bradford's proposal, legislators may still consider bills that would further expand what police records are made public. Place restrictions on, you know, legislators have until Monday night to vote on remaining bills. I'm assuming they didn't. Across California, the appetite for reform remains strong, though protests have faded. In a recent poll by UC Berkeley, 80% of respondents favor creating laws that would make it easier to prosecute police officers who use excessive force. But with attention focused on the state's myriad other troubles, the movement, the moment, is beginning to close. Samania Abdullah, head of Black Lives Matter LA, which sponsored the Bradford bill. She believes legislators use the abbreviated session as an excuse to avoid crossing unions. If only we had our own unions to strike when the police unions, and we could actually counter their power.
Yeah.
They're organized, and BLM technically is not as a movement. Even under the best circumstances, trying to get something done in 6 weeks. The closest thing we got to a strike was our kind of large protests that were just done in 1 week. And that's what got, you know, the Dems needing to act like they need to do something. And then now, of course, the pressure's off. And keeping the pressure on requires organization. Where you have kind of smaller ones, but that's not what gets the pressure on.
Right.
I know that on the one hand, we've had... That's where it becomes a manageable problem. Right. Bradford named the bill after Kenneth Ross. Okay, this is longer than I thought. Let's move on to the local version of this, which has a different kind of... But to play devil's advocate from the legislator side, they're in the position of, okay, you have the public will, which they want single payer, but then on the other side, they have to handle all the lobbyists and the industries with all of their power.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, they're like, look, if you really want this stuff, you kind of need to be organized so to force me to do it. And a lot of them, like, and this is kind of the rhetoric like Obama even had, where it's like, look, you need to force me to do stuff. Otherwise, it's Wall Street. And it becomes like this personal problem where, like, why didn't they stand up to Wall Street? Why didn't this one legislator, like, be able to do the right thing against all the threats of basically being outspent in the next primary? It's not like a progressive or someone to their left was going to outspend them. Justice Dems can't do that. And neither can BLM. BLM is, in fact, politically toothless at this particular point. In the public eye, you know, even now locally, there is an action every week. So, in fact, we are still in the streets. And they're getting, there's a lot of people. It's a lot of energy. But it's not organized. And or if it is going to be organized, it's going to be Dem entryism. It's right. going to be because the people showing up there are also Dem committee people because, well, those are the established community leaders. We don't have leftist community leaders in Albany. And, you know, the closest thing would be what I would want to establish myself as.
Yeah.
I'm nowhere near there. So here is from our local, this is 518 Independent. So I have to look at, like, whether or not who's actually behind this and who does the work here. The person who wrote this is David Howard King, September 24th, 2020. So last week. This is new news. Policing reforms proposed by Albany Council stuck in committee. A series of police reform bills, and I'm going to assert my own opinion a few times here. A series of police reform bills introduced by Albany Common Council in June in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, this is like literally a week after our quote-unquote riot, won't be getting a vote anytime soon. Councilman Kelly Kimbrough, former cop, who chairs the Public Safety Committee, where those bills are currently pending, said at a meeting of the Police Reform and Reinvention Collaborative on Tuesday that those bills won't be getting a vote until the collaborative finishes its work. Well, what is this collaborative?
Yeah.
That group, mandated by Governor Cuomo, isn't required to pass a reform plan until April 1st. So we'll all be fools when it's fooled, when it's passed. And its meetings so far have not been home to much discussion or debate.
Yeah.
It's a blue ribbon committee. When asked about the legislation, Kimbrough said that through conversations with, quote, leadership, meaning police leadership, and the mayor, it was decided that, notice he doesn't have to say police leadership, he just says leadership and the mayor. Isn't the mayor leadership? Whatever. Maybe it means council leadership.
I don't know.
But he didn't specify in his quote, or it was cut off by this writer. It was decided that it would be a disservice to our residents to pass legislation before having discussed it with members of the collaborative and the community. The council announced the package of reforms with much fanfare on June 5th, with Council President Corey Ellis saying, "This council has heard and understands that the citizens of the city would like, so we have in our capacity as legislators, would like to begin the process of addressing some of those concerns." Does that sound sincere to you?
Nope.
Okay. Just checking my own sanity, because when it comes to Corey Ellis, opinion, I've always seen him as a sellout or someone who believes he's buying in, but just like this, the way they talk, just the how, like, let's dissect this line a bit. I feel like this is like, to understand, like, why do I feel this is humbug? This council has heard, we hear you, and it understands what the citizens of the city, so citizens, so not residents or whatever, would like. So we know what you'd like. So we, in our capacity as legislators, so thus he's using legalistic language like he's writing a bill, would like to begin the process of addressing some of those concerns. So it's like, he can't say what the concerns are or any, like, it's all very vague. It could mean anything. Or it means nothing. 7 days later, Cuomo issued an executive order. This is 7 days after they put out their agenda, which to me was part reforms that would have been radical proposals back 40 years ago, but were to me, a younger person, milquetoast. Now, to older activists, including Barbara Smith, you know, where in her day, she couldn't be an out lesbian. You know, so we made, in her view and many other radicals, amazing progress over the last 40 years. To my 32 butt, I'm like, I think you're crazy for thinking this is somehow acceptable. The milquetoast reforms being proposed. It's not community control. It's pseudo accountability. Here's a list. But anyway, Cuomo, so after they proposed it, though, Cuomo's executive order, he made this executive order mandating the creation of police reform commissions. Localities that do not comply risk losing state funding for their police departments. So he'll defund the police if you don't do some milquetoast reform, basically. Or at least the, you know, just do something. Since the collaborative has started its work, major reforms have been announced in Rochester following the police killing of Daniel Prude. Maybe. While Cuomo's executive order is new, the issues addressed in the council legislation certainly are not. One bill would give the Albany Police Review Board subpoena power. The board is notoriously toothless and can only recommend punishment or mediation to the police union, which has the final say. Officers can simply refuse to comply and will have the backing of their union. What's the point of a law if it can just be ignored, right?
Yeah.
Or police or community will. We've met for weeks now, and I haven't heard real discussion. They are wasting people's time. They are not trying to solve anything, but those bills can make a huge change to the police department. We could have meaningful change right now. Why wait? This is activist Luke Forbes, who has called for the adoption of a number of the reforms, says that he feels the collaborative is delaying real action. So here's the voice of the guy on the ground. This is the voice to hold up. Further, Forbes notes that the presence of the APD, or the Police Officers Union President, Greg McGee, who makes many a racist tweet or problematic tweet,
right,
on the reform collaborative. You know, basically, the rhetoric of, like, we're protecting you guys from the horde of criminals out there. How dare you even question our integrity? Let's see. Oh, so Greg McGee, the union president, the police union president, is on the reform collaborative. And this is a reminder of where the power really lies, quoting Forbes. We haven't seen the police union's contract. We know they have historically stopped reform. So we need to know who their donors and backers are so we know who is supporting their efforts to prevent real change. So is it real estate? Is it, you know, the governor himself, and is he playing both sides? Dem machine people? Well, of course. Other bills put forward by... But, you know, we need proof, right?
Right.
We need reporting. Other bills put forward by the council would codify communication between the mayor, police, and the community. So at the moment, like, they kind of say we're all talking and coordinating, but it's all really kind of whether or not everyone's, like, having in a good mood.
Right.
Or pressure to talk or to be collaborative. There's nothing more disheartening than, like, okay, we'll work together instead of acting like separate fiefdoms. Because otherwise that's what happens. But to codify their collaboration. That they actually have weekly meetings. Because, you know, nothing says productivity like corporate meetings, right? Asked about the reforms earlier this month before Kimbrough's statement, Councilman Owusu Anan, nice guy, said he was aware that legislation was in committee, but that, quote, the police is under civilian control. That's how our democracy works. If the people want reform, that is what we are going to deliver, and the police department is expected to abide by it. Asked about her feelings on the decision to delay reforms about the collaborative finished its business, Corey Dobbs of Elevate 518 said she feels the initiative in Albany is just politics. So that's the way she phrases it. She could easily just say it's humbug, bullcrap. That's what kind of means when you say something is political, right? You're just making it about your individual power. But it's like, well, that's kind of what politics is power. Let me just finish this first. Dobbs questioned why it took an executive order by the governor to get powerful people like DA Soares, David Soares, and police chief Eric Hawkins, both black men, to commit to something with the smallest bit of transparency. Quote, quoting her, I'm not sure once this is over how we hold people accountable. It's like diligently tune in every week. But I don't have much faith we can uphold it once it's completed. I went to Barnes & Noble, and of course, like on the current events section, only a few books I actually found to be worth looking at.
Yeah.
One of them was from a kind of non-ideological point of view, but it certainly was from the greed or book against slacktivism and online activism, and mostly from the point of view of someone who is in the Beltway political circle, you know, horse race circles, and how he advocates for just being active in local politics. That many online and Facebook are just focused on the national politics, the national side, and that's where everything of consequence happens. And they don't seem to pay attention to local politics.
Yeah.
Seeming like either it's the, well, that's taken care of because it's all people who are, quote, unquote, on my team.
Right.
Ignoring whether or not they're actually serving the people or a majority of people.
Yeah.
When really they are just, they're serving those with power. And, of course, plutocracy, the people with power, the people with money. Whether it's the police union, people who fund them. Apparently they have outside funders. I don't know how that works. But I guess as an organization, you can accept donations from anywhere.
Yeah.
And of course, like until you have counterpower, this is all just going to be fig leaves. It's all going to be fake reform, or the reform will be on the table, but then it will go nowhere, like in California. Like you could have it all in like single payer exactly as it should be, but then the Dem leadership will not bring it to a vote, not cross that line. Because then they would actually have to, there would be a real fight. And whether, actually I have to cut myself off.
It seems like it's time
they don't
for
wanna,
our guest.
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll do that after the break.
Okay.
All right. So thank you for joining us. This is the Three Left Show. Another 30 seconds, actually. So I'll just finish the thought of, when it comes to people who are currently in power, of course, the last thing they want is actual, like, civil war conflict. And they do want to avoid that. And the kind of best way to do that is, well, it's not the best way, or the way they seem to be handling it is preventing us from building dual power, A. And if we did build dual power, it will still be like a, well, I can't really do anything. It's kind of balance, you know, we're balanced.
Right. Sierra Brooks, she is a fantastic leftist out in Ohio who's here to give us more of a Midwestern Great Lakes perspective, because we are much more familiar with the Capital Region.
We're Yankees.
Yeah, we're Albany, New York State area guys, and you can offer some awesome perspective on a different area and what it's like being a leftist out in Ohio.
So the floor is yours, and I'll think of...
All right, so you want me to start anywhere specific?
Wherever you want.
Like, what are you currently up to? Like, are you in organizations? What's the kind of work you do? Or are you simply?
I am actually involved in anything right now. I would like to be. I did try to with the it's called the Central Ohio Socialist Rifle Association. I was gonna try to start something out here, see if maybe I could connect with people that way. I'm not sure org is even active anymore because I haven't gotten any answers back, emails and messages over their Facebook account and everything, but that was an avenue I was thinking about taking. It was also the IWW website. I've been kind of thinking about trying to unionize my workplace. It's probably not going to work out, but I can try to do.
It's a good place to start, at the very least, to kind of learn more and get practice in. But hey, even like any drive like that will probably lead to at least a few more friends. Like just talking about union issues with, let's say, my supermarket job. You know, there were at least two people that I could actually talk about the issues. And they were kind of more shift manager side. So like they were there full time. They were full timers. But they were also just more less just work driven.
Yeah, I think I kind of want more and trying to communicate leftism and sort of our ideas to a more Midwestern audience, because I have found in my experience that a lot, especially in my, I don't get to talk to a lot of people in real life, so a lot of my over the internet, especially through Facebook and things like that, is lefties from city areas don't know how to communicate with people in the Midwest. And I think you need to meet them on the issues that they care about in particular. A lot of these people aren't very politically active. They can't really be bothered to care. They just want to live comfortably. So you have to meet them on the issues that matter. And I think a huge problem worth pointing this out more now is writing everyone off. They live in the South or the Midwest.
So I hear this conversation over and over. We don't fall into that, or at least I definitely work hard not to. So why don't you go through a battery of those things like you they care about, the things that, say, us Yankee leftists are not addressing?
A lot of it has to do with employment. I think it has to do with unions, some forth on that. It is kind of strange. A lot of people are in the Midwest, a lot of the trade jobs are the big ones that people are into, and that's where most of the money is. That's why a lot of people are encouraging their children to get into trades now to kind of try to make a life for themselves. But there is also somewhat of an anti-union sentiment overall, and I think that comes from being in the state of Ohio. There are a couple other states in the Midwest that has. I'm not sure if you do you know about those and all that.
Well, trade unions, of course. I mean, in fact, sometimes trade unions are the most militant that exist. They're the ones that will actually, like, go up to their foreman or whatever and break their legs. I've heard stories. Especially, this is from a guy in our area who's in the Socialist Party, or at least adjacent. No, he's definitely Antifa. And he's in a carpenter's union. And so, and they do not play around with their because they work as a team, they get what they want as best as they can.
That's how you do it.
So
yeah, but part of the right to work laws is this idea of right to work without a union, and that you shouldn't have to pay union dues, and they have propagandizing and making unions look evil, when that's how rights, a lot of the time, is that's how you get representation, to have a little bit more of a say so in how you determine your wages and your working hours, and everything important. So I think unions are a huge one, should be talked about more. I actually have a friend I actually run a Facebook comrade posting. Very, very niche. It's like a leftist Star Trek group.
Yeah.
A mod team, an admin and mod team. His job. Okay.
As kind of things go on in the anti-unionism and the right to work, quote-unquote, legislative movement from Alec, let's say, has carried through, do you feel that the people who are on board with that and anti-union, have they, this constituency, have they noticed that their quality of life have not improved, or do you feel that they're actually satisfied somehow by how things have gone? Or have they just gone nationalist?
I don't think people have very strong opinions about it at all, about the sort of union-busting attitudes of some of these laws. I know that one of the main things that mobilize people, like my parents are very apolitical. They don't get very much involved, but I do strongly recall when Obama won the first time, when they found, or no, I think it was the second, because Romney was a vehement union bust, very kind of strict about that. Mm-hmm. That is what most actually go out and vote. That was an issue that they actually did go out and vote. They usually typically abstain from voting. So that is one of the major things I have seen mobilize people on the ballot.
So you could say they're single issue voters. So the single issue voters, and you have, say, the rural America that are also think in terms of single issue voters, mostly in terms of job creation, let's say, because we have cultures of work and the dogma about work of like, well, your value isn't work, even if it's complete waste of time. Or meaningless work, that it's better to create jobs. And this is why, like, I roll my eyes when even when lefty or progressive friends talk of job creation or the need to create jobs, because this is the means of surviving in our system, instead of trying to do something different, which would require a different infrastructure, a different dual power. But it's like, well, we got to start building that if we're going to have something better. But instead, it's just kind of, well, we need to kind of keep on keeping on with what we got. But what we got is killing us. So what kind of takes do you have? Like, so let's see, you mentioned you're a fan of Bo of the Fifth Column. And my question, of course, is then, like, what, through your experiences, what kind of platform do you feel would be enticing or at least start the conversation for them or be make you comfortable in doing outreach and would people like you to do the outreach?
I actually had a short list of a couple content creators I would recommend. This person that isn't really politically activated either. One of them was that view of that I had Trey Crowder and a Dixieland podcast. They have a nice Facebook page and everything. I haven't actually listened to their outreach through that.
Who's Trey Crowder?
Trey Crowder is a redneck lefty with a thick Southern accent.
Okay.
Who is
maybe good. I have seen him, but I just don't.
He has a lot of good videos.
He lives in Alabama.
Posts.
I didn't want to confuse him with Steven Crowder. But again, my thinking is like, okay, let's say the Green Party's eco-socialist platform. It's definitely like gets people perked up when and they read it and they like it and they're like, yes, this is the kind of politics I want to fight for. It makes me care. Let's say it's only for people like in urban areas or suburban areas, and rural people don't click with the kind of value system that eco-socialist platform kind of is built on. What kind of do you think there's a way of, like, let's say, like, the reason why the attitude of we can't reach these people is based on their values. Is there a way, do you feel, that there could be a platform that is socialist that could be built on those values that then still deals with, let's say it's communalistic, but I know that, say, because, look, we're here in upstate New York, but we have rural Trump voting counties. Right. It's not just state by state or region by region. And especially, you say you're in Ohio. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as culturally concerned, like, Ohio is Yankeedom. It's still the industrial Rust Belt area. But in the rural areas, yeah, everyone believes or wants to be independent and self-sufficient. But of course, if farming is to make you self-sufficient, it means you're selling on a global market. And thus, you can't just care about what's in your own county. This government federal subsidy, is like, you have to be on the roll somehow. And of course, they all resent that. And of course, they do. I don't besmirch them for that. And like, where do we go from there?
Well, I think to kind of get them interested, they look to very specific content creators, and that's why I like people like the View of the Fifth Column. I think a lot of lefties are aggravated that there are And there are a lot of white men in the sort of politics sphere of being content creators, but that is what Midwest people look for. They don't want to listen to trans people of color or anything. They want to see that message coming from someone who looks like them, who looks like they know about how they live and has that sort of culture. So those are the people that they look, people like Trey Crowder have that kind of influence. Their videos and stuff I've seen of like there's a guy that lived somewhere in the Midwest, I'm not sure where, but he kind of has that very classic Midwest look, kind of that hick look a little bit. And he has a Black Lives Matter sticker, like, and he said he would have people come over and like knock on his window to yell at him, and he'd roll the window down. And he said they would look at me and like just be like, they're like, you look like you're supposed to have my opinions.
Well, Sierra, I know that
there's a very specific look that they are looking for to listen to them.
I know that you've talked about gun issues as being a topic that we'd be able to sort of bridge the gap and have
proof to
conservatives and people in rural America that no, leftists are not like the super anti-gun nuts that the liberals are.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could just talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I can start this anecdote. So I went to a career center that has a lot of different kinds of trades. It's a trade school, basically. And I made a good friend there who was a year younger than me, and we're still good friends today, and kind of libertarian adjacent. I don't know that he ever really identified. He was
sure,
sort of
but
that,
libertarian
right,
adjacent,
you know?
Sure.
And he very much operated under the assumption that a lot of them do, and that's that if anyone is left of center, they hate the right wing to hate guns. So when I kind of explained to him, not like we, it wasn't, I kind of got into discussion. It was pretty civil.
Sure.
And I told him, do not hate guns. And I explained, showed him one or two, probably the cause of the, about the guns thing. And he's like, wait, really? And then that left him open to more ideas. And I actually got him to vote Bernie in the primaries. He did that. He loves Bernie now. In fact, he's kind of big now. I may have created a monster, but but I guess
well, yeah,
I got
you,
him
I mean,
on the Bernie
change,
thing.
You change, like, yeah, like, that, that's kind of the, if you get pushback from, like, say, Facebook leftists, Twitter leftists, slacktivists, that they're thinking in terms of, like, fear-based, like, well, you can change the outward opinions, like, you know, direct where their energy is going towards one from the one idol to another. But as long as they're kind of dogmatic as far as their base value system of individual responsibility first, and so on and so on. So do you feel like in your friend that you've seen any kind of, there's always going to be these kind of ideological shifts. So it's not like he is changing as a person more or less, as we all do time to time. If people speak of like, the you know, these hicks are hopeless. Some of it is from a kind of like, they're not going to be able to change this innate part of themselves that is five generations old.
Completely turn them into a raging leftist. The goal should be to get them far enough over that they're not enemies, basically.
Yes,
that
and
they,
that's the assumption. Yeah, that's the assumption.
Of our ideas and
yeah, that's the assumption I'm working with, working against here, where like those say Twitter leftists are thinking in terms of like, you need my line, and since their line requires their experiences and worldview.
Right.
Very specific line, and that's how you kind of get the bad kind of sectarianism where it's like, but then it's the same kind of inner working that you described, that say the trans Twitter activist can only relate to those who are like them, and thus they're going to see others as like, well, I don't expect you to ever understand me or be on my side.
Yep.
You can't be. And of course, that's dogmatism too.
Yeah.
But it's the same dogmatism that then, say, exists in the prejudice of, you have to look like me if I'm going to listen to you.
Yeah.
And it occurs even like class by class, race by race, living standard by living, lifestyle by lifestyle even. in our own cities, in Albany, that there are these divides that, of course, it's always a mosaic or a patchwork of these competing communities, not one community. But of course, we don't build that dual power or socialism or real movement without actual kind of communities that actually are communities that are inclusive, not either. They have to be based on something more concrete, like an ideological line. So that's where the fighting on Twitter about that kind of comes from. I'm more just describing my assessment.
I think what people need to understand about people of the Midwest is most of what they want is very basic. They have these broad ideas about what they want the world to look like. They want a little big house for the amount of family that they want to have. They want to have a nice yard to play in, the dogs can run around in. They want to have a job that they can feel emotionally fulfilled in. They don't want to suffer through it. They want to be able to do their work as they can and be able to come home at a decent time so they can have. But that's basically what all of us want. So really, you just need to show them that your ideas can give them that comfortable life that they want to have. Oh, do protests or be politically active. That's not their cup of tea. That's more our cup of tea.
Sure. I mean, there seems to be a point of, like, maybe I'm projecting here pigeonholing, but it's like, there's this need to feel special in that, like, look, I'm special in that I only care about my basic needs, or I'm special in my, like, I'm like this, maybe this ties into the victimhood complex too, that, like, I'm special because I'm X or I'm a rural person. But of course, sure, maybe people who live in rural areas are in fact a minority. And thus, the kind of, like, well, I'm oppressed because I'm this type of minority, the rural minority. But we're also the majority, and we're silent, and we're ignored at the same time. So what kind of, like, I'll return to my kind of my other platform question of, like, well, what, let's say we build, like, this mass movement party. Let's say it's a green left party. Or do you follow along the line that the only way we can entice or, let's say, attract people is by not identifying as socialists or leftists, or that we can do that and simply project, like, no, we are, in fact, like, more like you than not? Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, I think they've done a really good job of words of, you know, socialism, anarchism, communism. You should really know those words. Even Bernie, democratic socialist thing, they're still saying you just can't use those words. I myself, growing up and being educated here in schools, were the evils of communism, whatever. That is very much nailed into your head. It's hard to unlearn those things. Those are scary words. I can get people to agree with me on different economic and social issues. I don't use those words. And I've had those conversations. I've had those conversations with conservative family members or friends of the family that will have those sorts of conversations. And as long as I don't use those words, agree almost fully with me on certain issues.
Do you feel that if you did use those words, at least towards the end, that the unlearning could begin? Or are you just kind of putting up? Do you write off on, like, you say it's very difficult, but would you write it off as something that's not worth doing, or that it's something that needs to be done eventually? But kind of like my other rants, that it's like, well, it kind of has to start somewhere, and it can start with that conversation that the conversation we have.
I would say start with normalizing socialism.
I would say
leave out the A word and the C word. Mm-hmm. But you can say socialism, try to warm them up. I think Bernie's done a great job of that through democratic socialism, and people often went from that to just operating as, I think he's done a great job at normalizing that word. But I also think that fears towards those ideas will not go away, actually changing our education system. And I really don't see that going away anytime soon. They've done a great job at those things are bad and evil, that we should be scared of them. And these these people have been life, I don't think they're going to want to trusting some of those words.
Well, that sounds
especially the older book.
But that sounds defeatist to me because, or it seems fatalist. Fatalist is what I mean. That YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, I mean, all of our social media seem to be filled with stories of people who were, like, in fact, indoctrinated, but they unlearned it over even just a short amount of time of, like, oh, my God, my eyes were open. Of course, and of course, the whole distrust of mass media, corporate media, is predicated on we were taught all of these things about fairness and stuff, but it was all bull. And so it seems like people overall, unless they are over age 40, 50, are ready to basically, their belief that socialism and communism are evil only hinge on either being a continual feed of anti-communist propaganda from PragerU, or they don't watch any of that. Maybe it's in their periphery, but it's like it's on the razor's edge, and they could easily just be pulled towards, oh yeah, all of that didn't make sense at the end of the day. And it is more gray or nuanced. And me believing myself to be rational boy will consider the evidence again, like for that I was lied to, because of course I was lied to. I already believe I've been lied to all the time. That's why I'm a QR.
Yeah.
I know that one of the things that leftists like to push is trying to get people to read theory, but I think what you don't think about when you're suggesting that people read theory is that how old a lot of it is, and the language in it is not very accessible, especially to maybe less educated or perhaps people with some kind. It makes it very difficult to read those things. So one of my many projects that I'm actually working on is trying to sort of rewrite those old books into more modern language, so
that
it's more accessible, more understandable to a broader audience.
There is theory that's been written in the last 30 years, mostly from like critical theory outlets like Zero Books or Verso Books. Have you checked any of that work out? Because some of it is almost reformulations of the old stuff, but then put into like, now I'm going to apply it to our current situation.
Well, right now, Sierra and I, we're working on a project where what we're working on right now is the Communist Manifesto. And yeah, I think we're about 4 pages in from about like, it's about a 40 page document.
Sure.
And so we're about like 4 or 5 pages in and just trying to update some of the language and make it non-alienating to non-leftists.
Sure.
Like, for example, the phrase is bourgeoisie and proletariat.
Yeah.
Are
you replacing that with elitists?
I use corporate elites.
Corporate elites, okay.
And the workers.
Okay.
And those are, that's, and just substituting that. And Marx used the examples from his time of the different wars and the different empires, and reforming that in, like, he talks about different technological advancements, and we format that around neoliberalism and the internet instead of the Industrial Revolution and
the Civil War in France.
Exactly.
The
Paris Commune.
What's odd is, so I've read the kind of documents from the 60s, the manifestos and stuff. And in fact, it was in Barnes & Noble. It was in the Feminist Studies book shelf. It was basically a Verso-published book of feminist manifestos. And it basically had all of them in there.
Ooh.
Both from, some from the 20s, from like Goldman, but then also bunch of them from the 60s, majority was, and then some from the 90s. Any kind of punk or feminist like stuff from the manifestos, from the punk stuff from the 80s, 90s, definitely more relatable, because that's when you get grunge and the kind of culture that we're in. Yeah, a lot of it was already updated in the 60s because you had all of these, like, you know, Americans, and then their concern was probably more translating it from European and continental theory to something that's, you know, for the beats and the hippies. Or they wrote their own versions, like from the Students for a Democratic Society, other kind of radical groups. Yeah, and just having that available. I saw a good YouTube channel that was just like, they actually called their videos pamphlets. So like little socialist pamphlets, and they're almost PragerU style 5-minute pamphlets. They're socialist video pamphlets. So that's kind of like the kind of
media. I've been thinking we need more of those. People watch PragerU videos a lot. They make it very
accessible.
Easy to digest really quick information.
Except it's not, yeah, I mean, it's pseudo information, really. It's, I mean,
that's true.
When you actually kind of look and go through them, it's like, what are they really saying? It's just like, it's more like the animation does all the talking. And eerily enough, I saw an ad for a kind of animation software. It's not really software, really. It's more like, in the same way that Squarespace has all of like the software to build a website, really,
yeah,
with just like drag and drop elements, this platform was like, pay us a subscription and then you can do that for animation. And they literally have this bank of thousands of objects and elements that you then put onto, and then you basically can set animations for them to do, which kind of makes like the kind of like style of video from the last decade where that has animations in it, you can do it in a really basic fashion now, and it's like, that's actually tempting, though it would add another 5 hours of work onto whatever I'm doing if I were to add in, you know, actual video. But I think we needed like kind of we need videos to, I would like videos to properly discuss each of the parts of Paracom or participatory or socialist economics that are community based and not just outside the paradigm of the either it's state socialism or it's welfare state socialism, which I'm very, if I'm pessimistic about options, it's those options, because as far as our government is concerned, the only way we can actually do anything is if we have a straw man. So if you want the government to do, like as it is, to do something, like say implement single payer, we're kind of need a strong man to do it, which is where all the fears of like, when this person becomes president, it will be the end of American democracy. And then it's just a fight over who the strong man will be. And of course, Bernie Sanders is the opposite of such a strong man. Who would be like, and then no Democrat running in a in the party would ever count as that. There would be a strong man for Wall Street. Or for the court, for the monopolies.
I think it would be beneficial to have a candidate who runs for president, like say with the Green Party, on the premise of putting in all of the positive changes that need to be done, and then as soon as they're done with that, abolishing the office of the presidency.
Well, yeah, but that's almost like what. So I'm going back to like my Roman Republican history, the end of the Roman Republic. Was you had a calcified political system that, because of monopoly power and inequality, as well as outside factors of invasion and a lot of population under Roman control that were not citizens but wanted to be treated fairly, so citizenship was needed, so there's a crisis there.
Yeah.
And there's all these issues and reforms that needed to be passed, but then calcified political power couldn't do it. And you had the Gracchus brothers, which were the last like movement to reform. And they were both assassinated / killed in ways, you know, crazy ways. So at the end of the day, you needed the figure Sulla, who was a general, strong man who took power, killed all the opposition, literally put their heads on pikes in the forum. And that was like, and he passed the reforms. And then as soon as he passed the reforms, he didn't, of course, abolish the office, but he retired immediately. But that set up this is how you actually pass reforms. And so Julius Caesar's a young man at the time, and then he's the next generation who, and then basically anytime any reform or political power needed to change, you need to fight a big civil war, you need to destroy your enemies, and then a republic is then an empire.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like either, if you want to see the cyclical view of history, which I don't, I like to avoid it, is let's say the America in the 21st century will kind of be acting like that, but instead of actual civil wars, it will be more like the political battles with more sporadic violence in like as we have it now.
Yeah. Well, we're on that path.
Oh, we're already in it. That's the thing. There's no transition into it. It's just like it's the way things have kind of been. It's just that that sporadic violence comes in the forms of beating protesters or political opponents that way,
yeah,
or buying people out. So it's done with, like back then, power was violence.
Yeah.
Now, since the Renaissance, power has been money. Maybe the transition into the next century will be its social power, social capital.
Yeah.
So it's whoever has power's the most followers, you know, just this is the really blanket, you know, simple way of putting it. It's like the person with the most followers and the most social capital will then be the person who can bludgeon their enemies and thus with canceling.
President Dwayne The Rock Johnson, anyone?
Something like that, yes. But that's the, I mean, when you look at the supporters of Jesse Ventura, that's what, I mean, it has that kind of, you have the strong man will have a cult of personality. They will have social capital, not political expertise or any kind of other expertise, but they will be at least the vessel for reforms. And the reforms will either, they will fix the problems of the crisis, but they will not fix the underlying problems. Like, you know, to solve Rome's problems, you have to basically change the economy. And that's kind of what we're advocating for, because as long as we're just going to have another crisis in 20 years.
Yeah.
You'll go from one strong man in 2025, and then we'll need another strong man in 2040 to clean up the next mess. Let's say when Manhattan starts to actually flood.
Yeah.
Something like that. Or when the storm surge comes in and it happens all at once, which is one sci-fi book that I was reading. So sorry, Sierra, we've been talking over you a bit.
No, you're fine.
Yeah. So do you have more to what area? You said you're in Ohio. What portion of it are you in?
I'm in Central Ohio.
Yeah, right in the middle. Why would you I have a semantic challenge for you. Why would you consider Ohio to be part of the Midwest? Or is
I
it, or there
don't
are,
know how to answer that question.
Yeah, I know. That's why
it's always been considered a part of the Midwest. I guess culturally there are a lot of similarities, like a lot of almost the same culture, and it's state by state. Some states have their own little quirks, but in general,
of course,
you go to one state in the Midwest, you've been to them all for the most part.
So you feel that Ohio has
one of the
things
culturally significant, and this is actually a bit of a funny one. One of the more cultural about Ohio and like two surrounding states is the concept of the drive-through convenience store. People are so baffled when I tell them about this. We have doors that are just drive-throughs. You drive through a building, it's like a U-shaped building, and you just drive through it, and they have a row of like snack foods, there's fruit of milk and eggs. So it's just like a little convenience store you drive through. And it's a really simple concept, and we've been around it our whole lives and we never thought about it until you actually look at this on a map. Like, all of them are in Ohio, or in two surrounding states. And people are so baffled by that. But that's just some little cultural quirk that we have here.
I feel like there must have been some kind of use law or vacuum in zoning rules that allowed for this to occur. Because, I mean, in any other state, the thing that would prevent
maybe
it from happening...
I actually don't know why they exist specifically here.
But why Ohio as a state, not just like locality by locality. But, yeah, it's odd. Maybe it's the way Ohio implemented their zoning codes. Because zoning basically became a... Similar to kind of police reform. It's like you have this kind of blanket. Okay, everyone's got to have their commission to do zoning. Since New York's did it, and it's working out. And it's solving some various capital issues. So everyone else needs to do it. And we'll let them do it state by state. And then I guess Ohio just kind of was like, oh, yeah, you can combine vehicle drive-through with general retail, I guess. But of course, that's what any fast food or bank does. So why not do this with a convenience store? It's
it was so normal. That's why it's really normal when you grow up here. Other places, and you realize they don't exist, or you talk to people from out of state, and they're like, what the frick is a drive-through convenience store?
No, sounds pretty intuitive to me. We don't have them, but obviously, like, well, of course, this is I mean, it just sounds like normal America stuff. I mean, we love our cars. We never want to leave them. So why not have a drive-through, anything that could be made into a drive-through? So I suppose the confusion would be it's not something you imagine because you like maybe you want to pick a snack, but I guess
usually have someone in there that gives you your stuff.
Oh, okay.
You just give them the money and you tell them what you want.
Right. Yeah. So it has more in common with a regular drive-thru. Why not do that? So it definitely comes down to some like, oh, there was no law against it. No one complained when they first set them up. Why would they? but why would anyone in Albany complain? But yeah, but there's a culture of fatalism of like, oh, they're not going to allow that, so I'm not going to try doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, or it's like I would do it, but then someone's going to challenge it, or I have to defend doing it, and that means fighting or defending myself, and that's I don't know if I want to do that. That's effort, you know, or it's more effort than it could cost me big, especially in say where there's machine politics. You step on the wrong person's toes, you lose everything.
I never thought about, I like your zoning laws. I never had thought about that because I remember thinking, you know, if I moved into another state, I wonder if I could open one and it would be like a weird little novelty thing and that's where the business could come from. But now I'm wondering if it is specifically allow those things to exist that they are not allowed to exist in other places. So I'm going to do more research for that.
So my co-host is showing me a meme with Ho Chi Minh. It's called Imperialists Hate Him in big red font. Defeat the whole West with this one weird trick. So I guess it's life hack category.
Yeah, I saw that and I just was like, I need to share this. It's so funny.
You got to put yourself in Facebook. You got to get zucked again, dude. But hey, he's prepared now. He has like 5 accounts.
Yeah. Well, Sierra's the one who made the profile picture for Vermin Sanders.
Oh, you did? So his newest one is Vermin Sanders, where it's Sanders with an eye patch,
yeah,
Vermin
it's...
boot.
I made that Photoshop for
good,
him.
Good job, Sierra. Good job.
I'm so thankful for that Photoshop job, because that is probably like, if I were to have a single image that encompasses my personal political beliefs, it would probably be that picture of Vermin Sanders, of Bernie Sanders, but even older in 2024 with an eye patch, beard, and scar with Vermin Supreme's boot on
his
head.
Well, it works off of the other memes where it's just like year to year you get more battle hardened.
I got it.
But we're still just,
at
this stage.
We need to make a Dragon Ball Z fusion meme out of this.
But at this
Bernie
state,
and Vermin fuse.
Oh, yeah.
The ultimate
that,
hero.
That does sound like a good meme. I will defer to you for the Photoshop.
Their
that
ideologies
sounds...
are in conflict,
I will do that
though.
Later.
Their way of doing things are in conflict, though.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah. But in the end of the day, we're still like not organized, and we're not like... See, like I had a thought about military drilling. I was watching Glory on Netflix, as one does with random, the top movies, you know. And I'm still a normie when it comes to like that kind of media habit, I guess. But anyway, I'm watching Glory, and you got the military training scenes, and it has all the tropes of military training in it, like a dozen other movies have. But it also made me think of some of the pseudo black power groups here in Albany and elsewhere that kind of work off of the legacy of Marcus Garvey and the Black Panthers. Not quite learning the lessons really from my point of view, but hey, I'm not black and I'm not in that community. So, but though I live adjacent and stuff, but one of them had a group of preteens doing military drills, about 8 of them, and he had them drilling.
Hey.
And it kind of both looks silly, intimidating, maybe concerning, like what is he really training the kids for? But I know that the drilling is also just like discipline, self-discipline, but also particularly, and this is more important about the military drilling, discipline in a group. So I mention all the time about like how groups and orgs, we just don't have discipline. We can barely like... if leadership puts out, you know, you could democratically come... Well, first, step one, democratically consensus-driven decision-making to come to some line about, like, here's what us as an organization is going to do. First, you have the battle to do that. And that's hard. It takes good facilitation to decision-make. Then you have the, let's say you have your decision. And then even if you're using consensus, right, you have, if you don't know, you have the freedom, like, you know, if you're following some anarchistic or ANCOM values, you're not going to force any one member to do anything. So right. It's like, it's a, hey, consent, you know, consent's important. You have to consent to this decision. Otherwise, you don't have to do it, even if you, let's say, you're a supporter of our org or you're in it. But that's also then the opposite of discipline. Everyone kind of going their own direction. It's still herding cats at the end of the day. You can have your decision, but if you can't enforce it through group discipline, it's meaningless. Police and other, our enemies, they act as a unit mostly, and they seem to have some kind of group discipline. Now, in Black Bloc, there is a type of group discipline that is flexible, but there's still a captain who's like, okay, if she says we're going this way, we're going to go that, you know, we're going to discuss it maybe a little, but we'll go that way. Or, you know, if she decides like, okay, it's getting too hot, okay, we're not going to argue about it, let's go. And the discipline of drilling is like, the thought came to me of, it's not so much about everyone conforming and doing the same thing, but so much as like the expectation of everyone else in your team, you like whatever you're doing, they're also doing. You trust that, you know, everyone knows the principle, the thing that matters perhaps is knowing what your teammates are doing. And either that requires an insane, maybe even bureaucratic amount of communication, or some type of like good planning ahead of time, which I guess falls under communication of, okay, everyone agree what the plan is, everyone knows what they're going to do, and knowing, trusting your teammates that they're going to do it, and you don't have to check on them. You don't have to, you don't need a manager, you don't need that kind of authority.
Yeah.
But like a team, a self-autonomous unit, you know, they act as a group, and military drilling or some type of drilling could be those things that maybe we feel silly when we first start doing it, but then right. By the time we're practiced, maybe we all feel like bad mothers.
Yeah.
But it's the stuff we kind of need to do, even as like to change our mindsets into thinking like units and groups and true solidarity.
Yeah.
Right. In the same way that those militant carpenter union guys do, like they're family, and they all know that like if, you know, they're all going to cover for each other and stuff.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts or things?
I'm just now picturing like
that goes for you,
a group team. Of black shirted Antifa members who are all doing military drills in Malcolm X Park.
Well, and that's where he did the demonstration.
Oh, he did?
There. I'm glad you brought up a little bit about the military. There is, I think, a problem with military recruitment in these small ways that are falling apart. When you look at it, a lot of them are falling. The factories that employed a lot of people have now shipped out overseas. So jobs, most that you can get a job at fast food places, businesses aren't rich, and they'll bring in any cool looking and buses and everything with neat paintings on it. They have this one big truck that has a bunch of simulators in it, and they do really good at like opportunity, but taking advantage of that these kids don't have a lot of prospects. They're not particularly smart or they're rich, and that's why a lot of people do these, because they can be good at that. But the military, hey, here's an opportunity to get out and see the world and not be stuck in this little town. But then they're turning you into cannon fodder, essentially.
And
it does change you. I've had Harry, and then something about basic training, not always, but something about basic people, because they're going in and they're breaking you down and build person they want you to be into a tool for them. People don't always come back the same.
Inherently.
And it's really heartbreaking to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's truly like the kind of, we can look at probably how Rojava trains its fighters. If they must have published like their manuals for their military drills? Like, how do you train someone to do for combat without actually destroying them as a person? Or how do you have discipline and the fact that, like, okay, when you're going to be given in a direction, you're not going to want to argue like a Twitter bot or a Twitter right. troll, argue about it for 10 minutes. Or that
it's a very strange real Afghanistan vet wants that he accept that.
Sorry, can you say that over again?
Nobody got seriously hurt with it. And he said some of the buddies in the trap and got messed up over it because they watched people almost die in front of them. It was a pretty traumatic experience. And he was upset that they had their experiences. And he basically suggested to me that the military should figure people out for that. And what you're suggesting is that they look for sociopathic people that they have emotional detachment from other people, sociopath. But there are everyday people that aren't serial killers or sociopaths. He basically said that they should only hire the military. It was a really strange opinion, I think, to have.
So yeah, your audio was really gargled. So I'll repeat. I think I understand what you were saying. That someone you knew in Afghanistan was suggesting that they should only hire the sociopaths who usually work for Blackwater, or they retire and become cops.
Yeah.
Or they go from soldiers to cops.
Yeah. Or become cops directly.
Or any worker in the national security apparatus.
Yeah.
NatSec, as it could be called. Yeah, because they have a detachment from the citizenry, but it's like they have the abstract notion that they are protecting America and everything we hold dear. Okay, so I think we can end the call. Thank you for joining us, Sierra.
Thank you so much, Sierra, for taking the time to come on.
Yes, we'll
appreciate it. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. Sorry about my audio quality.
We'll try different things. Maybe if we do this again, we'll try the Facebook call and see if that's clearer. This is Jetsy, right, which is the open source, non-recorded, non-corporate version of Zoom. So, otherwise, thank you very much. Good luck in all your ventures, and we'll keep in touch.
Well, first, my profound thanks for listening. An important skill, as important as talking. So we plan to listen to any constructive feedback that is sent in, ideas for the show or stories or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe work like ours is worth paying a living wage, but you can by supporting the show via its Patreon page. Support with your time by telling others you believe will be interested, liking and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts and pages, all found by searching Three Left Show on those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all or most podcasting apps, and a full archive of show notes and info about Dan are available at threelefts.news.
We'll deal with it off air.
Of course, the most important thing is to put the ideas, thinking, and projects talked about here in practice yourself. Thanks. Until next time, stay waving the flags of the three lefts.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Have a good one.